First of all, I would like to thank the organizers for giving me the opportunity to present our results. It's always very nice to come here to Santa Barbara and meet so many friends and see so many interesting talks. So what I'm going to discuss today is a project that we started about 1.5 years ago, where the idea was to predict from first principles new materials with exotic properties like unconventional superconductivity. And what I'm going to present today is some of the results we have so far in this project. So in this project, we have various colleagues from theory and experiment that are involved. So in Frankfurt, we have the PhD students, Daniel Guterding and Stefan Backes. Also, Cesalvat Pujol. I don't have a picture from him, but this one, it's a good approximation of how he looks like. So he doesn't like to have pictures of him, but this is good. So he's a Humboldt Fellowship who just now went back to Barcelona. Harald Jeschke, who has been my longtime collaborator in Frankfurt, and also Igor Masling from the Washington DC is involved. Frank Lescherman from Frankfurt, Ronnie Tomal and Mario Fink from Würzburg, and Hyun Pyo Lee, who was a postdoc in Frankfurt, and now he's back in Seoul. And from the experimental point of view, we have Paul Camfield from at Ames, Johann Mannhardt from the Max Planck Institute in Stuttgart, and Michael Lang and Cornelius Krellner from Frankfurt. So the idea has been to see whether we can predict new materials with unconventional superconducting properties. The question is, though, which are, in fact, reasonable theoretical tools to get these unconventional properties. And for that, let me first do a small review on what we know about unconventional superconductivity and the methods that have been developed to describe unconventional superconductors. So if we look at this diagram where we see as a function of time and temperature, the different families of superconductor materials that have been discovered since 1911. So we have here the very nice BCS systems with magnesium diboride as a big surprise for having quite high TC. And these materials are very well described by BCS theory. So this is a very nice predictive theory. We have also the heavy fermion materials, which are unconventional superconductors. Even though the TCs are low, it's basically correlation that it's explaining, or maybe it's responsible for this superconductivity. Here, of course, we have the high TC cuprates. These are the winners in TC. And emerging since 2008 are the iron nictides. And this is by no means not all the superconducting families that we have, but here are some of the representative ones. So let me just spend a little bit of time with the cuprates and with the iron nictides, what kind of methods have been developed during these years, and then see which would be the reasonable method that we can use in order to make predictions from first principles. So if we look at the high TC cuprates, these materials are mod insulators, and upon doping, one gets superconductivity at high TC, but many other very interesting phases. And if we try, in fact, to reproduce these complex phase diagrams for these materials by considering a one-electron approximation like density functional theory, it fails miserably because correlations are not described properly in density functional theory. So and here, correlation is, in fact, the driving force for the behavior of these materials. So in fact, the minimal model to describe these systems is the Hubbert model, which consists of a kinetic term and an on-site Coulomb repulsion. And even though this model is, as you know, the minimal model, still we don't have an exact description or an exact solution of this model in two dimensions. And an important issue about these materials is that we have always this competing ordered phase. So we have magnetism near superconductivity. And let me show you now another class of materials which are maybe less known, but they are also mod insulators that become superconductors upon applying pressure or chemical pressure, and these are organic kappa BDTTTF materials, which consist on these BDTTTF molecules that are arranged in pairs, and these molecules basically donate one electron per pair to these anions. And if we look basically at the, how these molecules arrange, they arrange in a triangular lattice, so that effectively what we have is a triangular Hubbard model with one electron per side. And by applying pressure, we have again here phase transition from a long-range or magnetic order onto a superconducting state, and we have also here various phases of non-Fermi liquid and similar to the high-TC cuprates. So again, we have here the Hubbard model on the triangular lattice, and we need the many-body, so to apply many-body methods in order to describe these features in these materials. What is interesting about these materials also is that some of them don't even order; they have a spin liquid-like behavior. So very recently, since 2008, we have a new class of materials, and these materials again show a phase diagram temperature as a function of pressure or doping, where one has in most of the families of these systems, they have a spin density wave order, though the systems here remain metallic, they are not MOT insulators in this sense, and upon applying pressure, they become superconductors. Here, of course, the main players are not copper and oxide and oxygen, but iron and arsenic, so a pictogenite or a chalcogenide. And from the very beginning of the discovery of these materials, the question was whether correlations are important in these materials. And I will show you the state of the art of the description of these materials and how correlations manifest, and with that, which methods, in fact, have been shown to be very powerful to describe these materials, and these will be the methods that we are going to use for our predictions. So maybe just to show the evolution of these of the TCs in these materials, so just right after the discovery of the first iron-based superconductors, a temperature of 55 Kelvin was reached in this 1111 material. We also have the family of the chalcogenides, and the maximal temperature reported right now is iron selenium monolayer on strontium titanate, though this is still, I don't think that there has, this temperature has been corroborated, but nevertheless, you see that there is a lot of effort in pushing the temperatures up for these materials. So if we do a one electron approximation kind of analysis for these materials, so basically we apply density functional theory, what do we learn about them? So what we learn is that if we look at the Fermi surface, so here is a cut at k is equal zero, the Fermi surface of these materials look basically, they have hole pockets around the gamma point and electron pockets around the M point. And basically, this spin density wave observed in some of these families can be understood, at least at the first approximation, as a consequence of nesting in this Fermi surface. Now, if we look at here at the band structure, what is important about these materials is that contrary to the cuprates, where we have that the most important band at the Fermi surface is the copper dx squared minus y squared, here in these materials we have all five D bands are in fact near or at the Fermi surface. So we are dealing here with a multiband Hubbard model, and therefore we have a new energy that comes into the game, which is the Hund's coupling. And if we look now at the superconducting order parameter, these materials don't show a universal superconducting order parameter like in the cuprates. So this is due to the symmetry of these materials. So there are various options and that have been discussed, and some materials show a S plus minus kind of superconductivity, but there is also a lot of discussion about some materials showing maybe D wave and maybe other kind of order parameter. I'm not going to go into that, but basically this is a subject of debate. So let me now, in order to go into our theoretical description of basically these materials from ab initio, where do we see traces of correlation in these iron-based superconductors? So we see traces in many different measurements, and let me show here the case of photoemission experiments. And I'm showing here the extreme hold-up case, potassium, iron 2, arsenic 2. So it's a hold-up case, so if you see the Fermi surface at this KZ cut, the electron pockets are gone because this is a hold-up system, and basically we have this hole pocket at the gamma point. And these are basically a cut at case equals zero, and these are case equal z. And these are the photoemission results. And if you do an LDA calculation, basically you see that one is not able to describe, in fact, the features, these Fermi surface features in these materials. So there is a stronger normalization that one needs to go beyond DFT to describe that. So a method that is very powerful, and one of the pioneers is our chairman, so Antoine Georges, is dynamical midfield theory. And what is important about dynamical field theory, so basically the basis of dynamical midfield theory is that you map the interacting system of atoms and electrons into one impurity atom, which is interacting in a bath of electrons. And what is important about this approximation is that the electrons in these central atoms have all the information of the dynamics that this atom shows by evolving in time by going through the different states. So what we have with this approximation is an exact description of the local correlations. And this already, including this kind of improvement into your description, already is able to describe many of the correlation effects in this kind of correlated metals. And what is important about this method is that one can link this method with the density functional theory, so we can basically from ab initio describe correlated materials by combining these two methods. One has to be, of course, careful about issues of double counting, but there is now quite a lot of experience since many years. I mean, if we look here, we're talking about 1992, how to deal with these effects. So the nice thing about this combination is that at the end of the day, we have spectral functions that we can directly compare with experiment. And here I'm showing, and going back to just this example, where we had here the photoemission experiments, here was what density functional theory calculation would predict. And if you now apply this machinery, including these correlation effects for your D levels, you get a very good description of, in fact, the topology of your Fermi surface. And it's not only the topology of your Fermi surface, you also get important information of what happens at high binding energies. So here I'm comparing the DFT with LDA plus the MFT, where you see here features that in fact are a consequence of the effect of your Kunz coupling and of your Coulomb Ur. So there is here, a lot of rich physics, Kunz versus mod physics, where also in fact, Antoine has been very much involved on that. So here I just used now these iron-based superconductors just to show that this method of combining density functional theory with dynamical midfield theory offers us a way of going now for predicting materials with unconventional superconducting properties. So I'm going now to basically the title of my talk, how can we now predict material. So we need to follow a scheme. So what kind of scheme are we going to follow? So where to look? So if we consider, for instance, the traditional superconductors, so the BCS superconductors, in fact, this is what we call robust superconductivity because it happens in your stoichiometric compound. When you go down in temperature, then the system becomes superconductor. So in principle, if we were to do a search of in the materials, that we have available. So theoretically, this is an easy search because you go and just hit one after the other since these are stoichiometric compounds. Now, these unconventional superconductors, at least the families that I was, that has the largest TCs, like the copper-based or the iron-based superconductors, these systems, in fact, usually, I mean, there are some exceptions, but they become superconductors when they are modified, either by selective doping or by pressure, and they are near competing phases like magnetism. So to do a search of this kind of superconductivity is going to be harder. Nevertheless, since we are interested in this kind of unconventional superconductivity, we're going to follow this route. And the question is where to start. So what we did is, of course, we know that these materials, they are all layered materials. And what is interesting is to find these kind of layered materials, but maybe that we play a little bit with different kind of lattice structures. So these are all square lattices. What about considering other interesting lattices like the Kagome lattice? So we started, in fact, by considering this material, Herbert Schmidthite. Herbert Schmidthite, this is a mineral. And if we look at the structure of this mineral, it's basically composed of Kagome layers of copper spin 1/2, so basically sitting in each of the sides of the Kagome. And these Kagome layers are separated by zinc. So basically, they are on top of each other, a little bit displaced, and this is the structure of this material. And if we look at the properties of this material, it basically, this system is a spin liquid. So it's a candidate for a spin liquid. It's highly frustrated lattice. It doesn't order at low temperatures, and it has been very much discussed because of this nice realization of a spin liquid. So if we look at this material by doing a normal density functional theory calculation, basically what we see is the following. So this is the band structure of this zinc copper, so this Herbert Schmidthite, because this is a complicated way to, I don't know how the chemists call that, so let me just say Herbert Schmidthite. So basically what you find is that you have a half-filled copper band, and you get a metal. And the reason why you get a metal is because this system is a Mott insulator. We know that DFT is not able to describe the gap in a Mott insulator, and we have to rely either to include the U or to go to LDA plus DMFT. So this is what the density functional theory gives us. But what we are interested in now is the following. So if we look at this band structure, and let me just now show the schematic shape of this band structure. Here, what we see is that it's a very rich band structure, the one corresponding to a Kagome lattice. So depending on the filling, you hit these flat bands, you hit these Bahnhof singularities, and you hit also this Dirac point. So what we wanted to do is, well, why don't we now, considering this material, try to engineer this kind of system by just doping and getting near to this Dirac point. So then we can try to analyze the kind of properties that you would expect for this material if you are able to dope it in this region. Okay, so what we did is we talked to our experimental colleagues in order not to do something that is not possible to be synthesized. And basically, the idea here is we substitute this zinc that we, so we have these layers of Kagome lattices separated by zinc. So we just substitute the zinc, which is in a valence 2+, by the neighbor, which is gallium. Gallium has an ionic radius which is very similar to zinc, but gallium is 3+. So being 3+ is giving 1 electron per every 3 coppers. So that means that we're going now to have this filling of 4 electrons per 3 sites. So we're hitting now this region here. Now, of course, this is what the 1 electron approximation gives us. We are here. But we are now not dealing with graphene. We are dealing with correlated copper D bands. So if we look at, in fact, the kind of hybridization, so this is how our orbitals look like. So basically, these dx squared minus y squared coppers hybridizing with oxygen. And if we look at the Fermi surface, so here is just a cut a little bit energy below the Dirac point. It has these kinds of tubes. The reason why they are a little bit, the shape looks like that, is because these Kagome lattices are a little bit displaced. But now we need to understand, or at least to analyze this kind of instability that we have here, by including correlations effects. So what do correlations do to this material when we are in this region? And maybe here I should point out that when we do this material from first principles, basically you build the lattice and you analyze the dynamics, so basically that this lattice is stable. So we calculate cohesion energies, we distort the lattice to see whether we go back to this lattice and it's stable. So we have to do all this ab initio analysis to make sure that at least from the point of view of density functional theory, this is a stable system, and it can be at least synthesized. So we did all these analyses, and this is a stable system. But let us look at now at the correlation effects. So what we did is now we do this combination of density functional theory with dynamical mean field theory. And in fact, here, we wanted also to include not only the local correlations, but at least correlations that also include nearest neighbors. So we considered what it's called the dynamical cluster approximation, where we also have three sites included in this impurity cluster. So now we take our DFT-derived model, and we apply this dynamical cluster approximation and look for instabilities of the system with respect to a Hubbard use on on-site Coulomb repulsion, but also to possible nearest neighbor Coulomb repulsion. So now what we observe is that this inclusion of U is not changing the metallic state at the Dirac point. And this maybe we can understand that, because if we think about now, let's consider the limit U going to infinity. At the limit U going to infinity, basically what you will have is three electrons are completely localized. And there is this one-third per site that is going to be basically making your metallic state. So it's to be expected that U alone won't kill this metallicity. But if we include, of course, if the system has a strong nearest neighbor Coulomb repulsion, at some point, in order to adapt to this strong nearest neighbor Coulomb repulsion, the system basically charge orders and opens a gap. Now, we estimated for this material how strong is this nearest neighbor Coulomb repulsion, and in fact, it's much lower than the limit when it starts to open this gap. So therefore, in principle, the system remains metallic at the energy ranges where we are working. So the next kind of instabilities we wanted to analyze is, of course, superconductivity. So here is where my title comes. In fact, so what we did now is, okay, we know that the system near the Dirac point is metallic. So we ask, so in fact, Ronnie Tomale and Mario Fink, they performed, so they took our effective ab initio model, and they performed multi-sublattices functional randomization group calculations, and looked, in fact, at the possible instabilities to a superconducting state. And what they found is that there is indeed, so here I'm showing the Fermi surface at different fillings, so by approaching this Dirac point, and you see that there is also a Lipschitz transition at some doping, where we go from this Fermi surface to these Fermi surfaces here. So now analyzing this superconducting instability, basically what they find is that the system is unstable to an F-wave superconductivity, so L equals 3, that corresponds, in fact, to these pockets here. So here I'm showing this structure factor of the superconducting order parameter that does these jumps whenever I go. So these are the cuts, the patches in the Fermi in this functional RG. So basically the cuts by going from 1 to 8, so I have to start. By going through here, you go around these patches. And this is basically your physical order parameter. So basically what we are saying is that this material, if one is able to synthesize, and in fact there are now at least three experimental groups that are working with these kind of systems, then you could observe, maybe you could find this kind of exotic superconductivity. So the question is though, well, this is one system with one doping, but we should now try to analyze basically all the possible dopings, all the possible substitutions to make the space of possible systems where you can have exotic properties, not necessarily superconductivity, but at least other kind of properties interesting. So of course, you can now think about other options. So here, I showed you the case of substituting by gallium, but you have other options, and scandium is in fact a very a very interesting candidate, where you could see this physics, maybe see this physics of unconventional superconductivity. Here is, in fact, what we know for Herbert Schmidheit. But what about this filling here? So let me just show you some results by considering the filling of, instead of having zinc, putting sodium, where what you do is you hold up the system. By hold opening the system, what we find, and again, we have to do all this analysis that these structures are stable. What you see is this is, in fact, a spin polarized calculation, since this system, in fact, the ground state is ferromagnetic. But what is interesting is that the Fermi level then is exactly at the Dirac point of the up spins. And if you consider also now the spin orbit effects, what you see is the opening of this gap, which is of about 6 to 10 millielectron volts. So in fact, we're now analyzing this, this region for this material, and also including the effect of correlations, because this is at the level of DFT. So yeah, thank you. So you see that, in principle, this Kagome lattice is of a playground for possible materials with interesting properties. And one shouldn't reduce maybe only to Herbert Schmidheit. There are other polymorphs that, like caprolite and hydride, and recently, in fact, barlobite is one possible candidate where this kind of physics could maybe be more possible than in the Herbert Schmidheit. And let me tell you why. So barlobite, in fact, John Schluter rediscovered this material because he was interested, in fact, in working instead of chlorine, working with bromine and fluorine. And let me tell you what is the chemistry here. So when we look at Herbert Schmidheit, I mean, of course, with a theorist, when we do the ab initio, we have to be careful to have all these elements in the right position. But in principle, when you at the end of the day you go to your model and you are not that interested in whatever is here. But any of these elements has its reason to be there. So let me tell you why chlorine is important in this structure. So chlorine, in fact, acts, so it's just below, this is my layer of Kagome, and this is the next layer of Kagome. And chlorine likes to bind covalent, so three covalent bonds, and three bonds, OH bonds. And this is very strong in chlorine. So what it means is that you will never, ever, if you have chlorine, you will never have your stacking of Kagome layers one on top of the other. They will be always displaced. And this is what happens in the Kagome, that you have these displaced layers one on top of the other. And then it may be difficult to have the proper cage of substituting zinc with another ion. So gallium is still of the same order of magnitude, but then you have to be careful whatever you want to put, because maybe there won't be place. So John, in fact, was playing with that, and bromide is a very different kind of bromine. In fact, likes to do covalent bonding for all the six bonds. So because of that, and fluorine likes to make this OH bonding in all the six bonds. So what happens then is that you get a stacking in this material, which exists, and it's a mineral, in fact, which is one on top of the other. And this arrangement allows, in fact, for a lot of void to include this cation that is going to do the doping, depending on what you put. So this is, in fact, another kind of Kagome systems that are very promising for these kind of topics. And now, not only now Kagome, but also triangular lattice. We saw this example of organic charge transfer salts, but one can explore even more the physics of, in fact, correlated systems on the triangular lattice and also on the honeycomb lattice. And not only here, I showed you mostly 3D, though we saw that, especially when we are at these Dirac points, we should take into account the spin orbit effects. But then going to 4D and 5D, and we saw already in the talk of Gang Cao, by doing substitutions and doping in these kind of materials, you can also try to see whether you can push the system to metallic and maybe even superconducting. So we are trying to analyze that from the point of view of ab initio and what it is, in fact, stable. So with that, I would like to come to my conclusions. Basically, by using this combination of density functional theory with many body methods. So here I basically presented dynamical mean field theory and dynamical cluster approximation. This is a powerful method to describe and even predict correlating materials from first principles. I showed you, in fact, that for the iron-based superconductors, this combination is in fact, giving a very good description of these materials. And then I show you our first results on predicting new correlating materials with unconventional superconductors based on the Hurwitz-Schmidt set, so based on a Kagome lattice. So if this kind of doping can be realized, one possible important stability is a F-wave superconductor. And of course, then one can really extend this kind of analysis to different dopings and different kind of atoms for D, 5D, and lattice geometries. And with that, I thank you for your attention.
I was wondering if you considered anything in the low doping regime, like a lightly doped spin liquid kind of physics?
That, in the low doping.
Yeah, that, so what that may I also did, be an interesting route too.
I know. Activity. So the low doping that we did is this one, basically. But now what you would like is to go maybe in the, okay, so let me put it here. So to start here, the half filling and basically run up. Yeah, this we need still have to do that. I mean, we first tried the dopings that are easy to deal with. Mm-hmm. If you want to do these kind of dopings, you have to deal with supercells. So your calculations are much more elaborated because the dopings are not these nice fractions that we have here.
But I guess it would be interesting to see some cluster DMFT or something.
Yeah.
Because those band structure kind of calculations aren't going to be very bad for this Strongmont insulator vicinity.
You mean here?
Near half filling. Yeah.
Near half filling, you surely have to do. You have to combine it with dynamical mean field theory, or dynamical cluster approximation, definitely. Otherwise, you won't get the physics. Yeah.
So in comparison to square lattice physics in cuprates or iron superconductors, what should we learn from your clarification of Dirac metal or the frustrated lattice structures? What is unique? Of course, I understand F-wave is a unique feature, but in addition to that, in the sense of mechanism or in some other aspect, what should we?
Yeah, so the mechanism here is that's why we chose a system. So we were interested in using the physics that we know from graphene, but then for a correlated system, and we wanted also to have magnetism somewhere in the game. And that's why we came into this Kagome, where you have magnetism. Of course, it's a strongly frustrated magnetism, but then we can just look at all these nice Dirac physics with this frustrated magnetism. Now, what do we learn for the square lattice? So here, again, because we are near these magnetic phases, we assume, at least for our estimates, we assume that if there is superconductivity, it's also going to be due to spin excitations. So no phononic kind of superconductivity. And then, basically, we are using, in fact, here we are using the concepts that we know from the square lattice, and we translate it here. Now, the other way around, I haven't think about that, whether from here we learn something new to translate to the square lattice, but I'll think about that. So up to now, I was just doing one way. Let me see what I know from the square and translate it here. But maybe we find here interesting physics that we can put it back.
So when you're doping your materials with gallium, should I think about these substitutions as some kind of impurities, or are they just perfectly matched so that they don't perturb the crystal structure?
Okay, so I have two answers. One is what our calculations show. What our calculations show is what we did also is exactly what you are asking. We put gallium out of the place, and gallium goes back to the place. So likes to be there, likes this binding. And second is what the experimentalists tell us. There are some first results. And basically, it seems that it doesn't go somewhere in the interstitial. So these are these two kinds of answers that I can give you. We definitely, in the calculations, make sure that it's not going to be some impurity in the interstitial. You don't have here, in any case, much place for it to go. So in fact, it goes down and it gets stable at this position where the thing was.
So let me just ask a follow-up question. So for these experiments, do you have a mean free pass measurement in these?
No, we are not that far. I mean, there is a lot of work to be done here. In fact, I must also say here that when you do these kind of calculations, you definitely cannot control all possible reaction paths that you could have in the real synthesis. So we tried some, but not all. And I was talking, in fact, with Martin Janssen, who is now at the Max Planck Institute he was in Stuttgart and he's now in Dresden, and he said he wants to try that, but he was telling me that there are many other paths that one should check, which what we're doing now, to make sure that you don't sort of dissociate in any other kind of system. So it's not that you have everything under control. You have much, but not everything, right?
So in the original Heber-Smith site, so it's known that some people think that one of the problems is that copper likes to go into interstitial places.
Yes.
So in your calculations, do you have some energetic, is there a way to kind of quantify this effect?
We did. I mean, I didn't show it here, but we did a lot of calculations by also putting copper, because especially copper and zinc, because they have the same ionic radius, they just switch, you don't like that, but they do that. So what we did is a lot of this stability and basically compare energetics by putting the copper then, and then with the copper in these positions, and then we find that in fact this is more stable by putting this gallium or even scandium, more stable than putting copper. So it's a little bit more stable when you do this substitution. The case of having in this interlayer gallium or scandium and not copper. But when you do the zinc system, you see that. You see these effects of copper sometimes going there. Also in the Kagome, this has been one of the problems on basically the experimentalist working on the Herbert-Schmidthide, is that you have sometimes also some impurities, zinc impurities, on your Kagome layer. And this is also a big problem.
So as a follow-up, is there a way to estimate kind of stable structure percentage of those substitutional impurities?
Well, to do that, again, you need to do supercells, because you have to consider different kind. So we did basically now here to analyze these energetics, we did the smallest cell, so the small unit cells that we thought would be reasonable. And there, we still find that when putting everything with copper, it's a little bit less stable than putting either zinc or, but the energies are very nearby. So if you just construct this system and put copper, it's stable. And then you have to start comparing energetics between these and the other cases. And they are nearby, so it's not going to be easy for the synthetic.
Okay, we have many questions. Maybe Hye-Yong first.
Okay, so given that you have F-wave, it's a spin triplet, so I would guess that the Hund's coupling is quite important. What's the ratio of Hund's coupling versus the Hubbard U here?
Okay, so here, in fact, we are dealing with dx squared minus y squared. You mean, here we're dealing with dx squared minus y squared, mostly. It's one band. So the Hund's coupling is here not as important as, for instance, the iron-based superconductors, as I was showing
to
you.
Then how do you get the F-wave, which is triplet, right?
Yes, but the F-wave comes because of the lattice symmetry. Let me show you.
I understand the lattice symmetry.
Yeah.
If you have a triangle lattice, you got a depressed ID
exactly.
From the lattice.
It comes from that.
But
you
it
see?
Is a triplet. So how you get the triplet pairing from the you or Hund-Scoppling, I mean, I cannot think of other than Hund-Scoppling that give you triplet pairing, because you don't have phonons or anything, right?
Well, I mean, we have all these parameters there, but I must admit that we didn't do an analysis with respect to these couplings. We basically looked at two instabilities. So here in these calculations, ferromagnetism, which was a competing instability to this superconductivity and superconductivity. But we didn't spend much time. I mean, maybe we should go back and analyze better this superconducting state. We didn't spend much time about the details of this superconducting state. We just have the symmetry, which is F wave.
Okay, more questions?
So I think you just said the gallium ionic radius is close to zinc and copper.
Can you say the
ionic radius of gallium, you said it's close to zinc.
Well, it's.
But I just searched. So
it's a little bit larger. It's a little bit larger.
Well, this is gallium 3 plus.
It's gallium 3 plus.
In coordination number 6?
Yes.
Certainly, it's much smaller than zinc and copper. It's about 62 picometer versus 74 or something like that. But did you do a full lattice structure relaxation to see the structure is stable?
Yeah. You do that. Okay. You do this. Yeah. You have to do this analysis. Otherwise, you are not sure that this is going to be your stable state. One thing I should say is, if you do now, we have also done that. So there is a way of really getting predicting lattice, so predicting a structure from scratch. So that means just by saying I want this atom, and this atom, and then give me the structure, which is by using genetic algorithms. Now, if you put this structure in genetic algorithm, what we found out is that it doesn't go necessarily to this structure. But the reason for that is because genetic algorithms are basically so these codes are basically written to deal with certain kind of bondings. So that means that it's not going to be good to use genetic. You have to modify your genetic algorithm if you want to catch this kind of lattices. I don't know whether you are familiar with genetic algorithms, but this is one of the methods that it's used a lot for predicting structures under high pressure. And these genetic algorithms, basically, you don't put any information, so nothing, only which atoms you put in the system, and let just by using genetics, so basically mutation of structures, and you just try to go into a global maximum instead of a local maximum, you try to predict structures. But for these kind of structures, one has to elaborate a little bit more on these kind of genetic algorithms, just wanted to mention.
So this is related to Hayong's question, the origin of ferromagnetism in this Kagome lattice. So I think you show that there's some flat band.
When I go to this holdup, right?
Right.
Yes, when I go here,
yeah.
You are in this flat band.
Yeah, so yes. In this sort of the simplest model, flat banding model, nearest neighbor hopping, where we have this flat band, I think then M Hubbard U is enough to give you a robust ferromagnetism.
Sure, but now let's go to the real system, okay? But I am not. I am here. So, the superconductor. The superconductor is here, up there.
Okay, I see. Okay. Thanks.
Okay, and I also showed results for this year. But here I'm not talking about superconductivity at all.
Okay. I see. Okay. Yeah. Thanks.
Gee, I have a question. Since I have a mic. So for this. N equal 4/3 case. Did you see any competing like charge ordering when you're doing?
Yes, you do.
FI
you do if you do. You do if you have a very strong nearest neighbor Coulomb
exactly,
repulsion.
Yeah.
But these systems are bulk systems, so they have quite a good screening, and we estimated from first principle. In fact, doing Thomas Fermi. We estimated this V, and this V is not that large. So it's below the critical V that would give you this charge order. But yes, this is a possible instability that you could have.
Because you are close to Dirac point, so
yeah.
Coulomb interaction is not computer screen.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So V is not necessarily small.
This is different from graphene. In my meaning, graphene, I agree with you. You don't have graphene. Is there is this 2D perfect 2D, and then you have no screening. But here you have your Kagome is in a 3D system, so still you do have screening. At least we estimated this screening, and is enough to suppress this charge order.